From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. As we go to air, stabbings and gun attacks have killed 8 Israelis this month, wounded many more. Israelis have killed more than 30 Palestinians, including 18 suspected attackers. Right now, there is no clear path to an end to the violence. We're looking at the latest outbreak of killing with a political scientist and 2 prominent writers on Israeli and Palestinian life. This hour on Point, understanding the new wave of violence in Israel. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you make of the now almost daily stabbings and more in Israel, the Palestinian fury, the Israeli response? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Hear the sound of sirens as paramedics ran with empty stretchers toward people injured after a Palestinian crashed his car into a bus stop in one neighborhood of Jerusalem last week. Israelis down. And here, a knife-wielding man, Palestinian, Wednesday, shot dead after rushing past a security checkpoint in East Jerusalem, right in front of the cameras of an NBC News team.
A man with a knife runs past a security checkpoint and is shot dead by Israeli police. The knife clearly visible in his hand.
After the break, we're going to talk with Israeli Jewish writer Etgar Karet and Israeli Arab author Syed Kashua. But first, joining me now from Washington is Gerald Steinberg, professor of political science at Bar-Ilan University, where he founded the Program on Conflict Management and Negotiation. Founder and president of NGO Monitor, a Jerusalem-based group that critiques NGO coverage of the Middle East and more. Gerald Steinberg, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've got the Group on Conflict Management and Negotiation. How would you assess the conflict management that we're seeing or not seeing in Israel right now?
First stage to conflict management is usually military security. It's to prevent the people with the knives, with the guns, sometimes with Molotov cocktails and lethal rocks from killing other people. And we're in that stage now. Until you have that overcome, until the immediate wave of violence stops or at least is reduced, then you cannot have, until that you reach that stage, you cannot really sit down and have some discussions about what it is that we can do for our mutual interest. That was the process in Northern Ireland. It's held for some time and now may be somewhat weaker. You don't overcome conflicts like this, deep identity conflicts, by having very visible public ceremonies, even by trying to discuss trade-offs until there's a real sense that there's a solution out there. That's what we call our program conflict management, not conflict resolution, because most of these conflicts really need to be managed. They need to be reduced to the point where you can have a civil conversation. That takes generations.
Why do you think, Gerald Steinberg, that this violence has surged now?
First of all, if you look at it historically, and I'm not saying it's mechanical, but almost every 10 years, we've had an outbreak of massive violence in 1929, and much of it starts in Jerusalem over the issue of Jerusalem. There are religious elements to it as well. There are political elements within the Palestinian community. There are a lot of different factors. It's not trivial at all. And I think now, first of all, it's been about 10 years, a little bit longer, since what was called once the Second Intifada. We have a different generation, a younger generation. They've been recruited. They've been trained. There's a lot of Israelis talk a lot about incitement. We see it on Palestinian media. We even hear it from the leaders of the Palestinians, Mahmoud Abbas talking about Israeli feet polluting the Temple Mount or the Haram al-Sharif, things like that a few days ago. There's a lot of escalation of rhetoric, and then at some point it becomes, in this case, it's the interest of Hamas, the interest of some of the radicals. Plus, we have a region, and that's very important. We tend to discuss very often in the media and elsewhere, and certainly in the United States, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as if there was nothing else in the Middle East, as if the border, the Mediterranean, the Jordan River were the end of the world. But if I drive 3 hours from my house, drive north and to the Golan Heights, I can see the fighting going on in Syria. I can see the ISIS, Daesh. I can see them fighting Syrian, Iranian, Hezbollah troops. I can see the shells going off. Occasionally they come over our border. That's part of the Middle East. That's a very strong part of the Middle East, from Iraq and Syria, Iran, all the way across to Libya, Yemen. You have this tremendous level of violence, and it's inevitable that it's also going to be spill over into our part of the world. It's not primarily or mainly about occupation or frustration. You talked about Palestinian fury. Where does that fury come from? It was there a long time before it was an occupation, and I think these are identity conflicts where both sides really fear that they're going to be eliminated, wiped out by the other side. They don't want the other side to win. And this is just one of those periods where the pieces were put together either deliberately or as a result of an unconscious process and spilled over into this explosion.
The explosion is being attributed in part to a Palestinian perception that Israel has been moving toward changing the security and control arrangements on Temple Mount, or Haram al-Sharif, as you say, the holy site there. Israel denies this, but I think within the Israeli cabinet there's a range of views on what access ought to be there and how that ought to play out. What about the treatment of this very sensitive subject? How do you assess the way the government's handled it? Did something happen that would, to your eye, merit suspicion on the part of the Palestinian community?
To be honest with you, one would have to say we don't know.
Well, you're there. I mean, you've been, I'm not sure. Explain, please.
On the one hand, on the other hand, that's what academics do,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, the first point I would make is the issue of what defines the status quo. Who defines it? How does that take place? From an Israeli perspective, and I don't think there's enough understanding of the Israeli perspective, why is it the positions of Netanyahu are supported? Why was Sharon supported back in 2000, etc.? That there has been a gradual, in some cases a very strong erosion of Jewish rights. And this is a city that we've been in for 3,000 years.
What do you mean by the erosion of Jewish rights? I mean, most of what we see is, yes, attacks which limit life, but also barriers going up, checkpoints going up. Most of them seem to impinge on Palestinian life.
Those are security measures. But in terms of the weeks that led up to this, that are the ostensible cause that were actually used to trigger this, and in some cases, I'd say cynically and manipulatively, Jerusalem's always been a sensitive point. So when I was a student in Jerusalem in the 1970s, everybody went up to the Temple Mount. Everybody went in and out. You wanted to go into the mosque, you go into the mosque. Mm-hmm. There was an agreement that Dayan enforced after the 1967 war. There would be no Israeli flag up there. There would be no Israeli sovereignty. It would be under the control of the Islamic authorities, the Waqf, and there would be no Jewish prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Those were concessions from the Israeli, the Jewish side. But in the 1990s, there was a pushback. A lot of those procedures after what was called the First Intifada, the late 80s, then it became almost impossible, and then it became impossible for Jews to go up to the site, which is the most holy site in Jewish tradition. Impossible to go up. And there was massive digging, massive excavation, and Jewish history was just dumped into basically a big pile outside the old city. After 2000, Israelis and Jews began to claw back some of that. Now, none of that is in the histories. That's how Israelis view this, as there's a strong effort to try to push us out of our holy sites by various Islamic groups. Plus, if you watch and see what ISIS is doing, it's destroying religious sites, historical sites, archaeological sites of everybody. That's the Islamic movement in Palestine, and Israel is doing the same thing. So from the Israeli point of view, this claim about that Jews are upsetting the status quo is in some ways very bogus. Now, I can understand it as an academic from the Palestinian point of view. And to answer your question, I think there was some activity that took place by ministers on the right of the Netanyahu government, and Netanyahu is often portrayed as a right-wing leader, but in fact he's center-right, and there are many people in his government that are further to the right, more nationalist than he is. Ministers going up to the Temple Mount at this time did not contribute to conflict management. I don't think there was enough attention paid to the spiraling of the process and the way.
What would they like to see, those ministers who have, some of them, gone to Temple Mount or Haram al-Sharif?
Well, some of them want to see a restoration of what they see as a status quo, what they grew up with after the 67 war, and not go back to the pre-67 period where not a single Jew was allowed into the old city. Let's remember the international community, including the United States, failed entirely. People don't remember the history to enforce the ceasefire agreements, which guaranteed freedom of access to Jews and Christians to the old city.
But would that justify Palestinian sense that maybe Israel's considering changing the status quo?
Well, I think in a lot of ways things are exaggerated and manipulated.
I'm just asking you factually what your assessment.
Factually, I would say absolutely not. Restoring the status quo to the way it was and agreed to in the late 60s and early 70s would serve everybody's interest, and we'll probably go back to that in some ways. But that's going to take some time, because since that time has come, and remember, we're seeing an Islamization of the entire Middle East. And so the Palestinian population is in many ways more radicalized, more outwardly religious, more exclusionary, exclusivist. This is our territory. They said the Jews have no place here at all. When Arafat in 2000 told Clinton and Barack at the Camp David summit that failed, when they were discussing Jerusalem, which is the heart of the whole conflict, the identity heart, the religious heart, the historical heart. Zionism, Zion is Israel. Zionism is a return, or rather Jerusalem. Zionism is a return to those holy sites, those historical sites, those core cultural sites. When Arafat said there was no temple in Jerusalem, that was basically the end of the negotiations. And Clinton said, what are you talking about? And they brought in, I think Dennis Ross said, they sent somebody to get an encyclopedia to show Arafat. Well, he knew. But that denial of the Jewish rights, of the Jewish history, that we were there, and at least the Muslims have to share it and acknowledge that, that's very, very difficult for Islamic leaders and just general people who like to see themselves as triumphant and the Jews as having become replaced.
And Jewish action in the decades since the 67 war, how much of the tension and the violence that you see right now would you put...
There you get the cycle issue, where the majority of Israelis, by every public opinion poll and measure, the majority of Israeli Jews, about 60%, 65%, favor an end to what's called the occupation, the post-67 situation, the uncertainty, an agreement on territory, two states. But they also say that we do not see a leader or a process or a willingness on the Palestinian side to recognize that and to go there. And therefore, that's allowed the people with more radical views, people who are religiously or otherwise inspired, what's often called the settler movement, although there's a difference of definitions, to go and expand that. There is an argument that's made about the weakness of the Israeli leadership here.
But Gerald Stemmer, hold that thought, if you would. We have to take a short break right here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the mounting wave of Palestinian stabbings and Israeli response. The conflict bloody again. You can join us this hour. Is there something different in the bloodshed this time or not? And what do you see in the Palestinian youths pulling out their knives, in Israel's response? Why now all of this? What do you see in the way these two communities are being led, being spoken to by their leaders? Is this another intifada already? Lots of stabbings, shootings now as well, and beyond Jerusalem. A week ago, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the current wave of violence in a speech in Hebrew here to the Knesset. And here's how he framed it. Reading here from a translation, we must understand once and for all, Netanyahu said, terror does not come from frustration because there's not a peace process. Terror comes from the desire to annihilate us. We'll look at that. And here is Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in a televised address last Wednesday talking about the wave of violence in Jerusalem, interpreted here by Euronews. Abbas.
These days, the Israeli aggressive assault against our people, its land, and its holy places is escalating. The racism is showing its ugly face and is making the occupation uglier.
Abbas points to racism and more there. We're talking this hour with Gerald Steinberg, professor of political science at Bar-Ilan University, founded the Conflict on Conflict Management and Negotiation. Not resolution, he points out, management. He's with us today from Washington. With us as well from Urbana, Illinois, Syed Kashua, novelist, columnist, television writer. The Daily Beast described him as Israel's most prominent Arab-Muslim author. He left Israel for the U.S. in 2014 because he felt he could no longer live as an Israeli Arab in Israel. He was profiled in The New Yorker last month in a piece headlined An Exile in the Corn Belt, Israel's funniest Palestinian writer decamps to the Midwest. He's author of Second Person Singular, Let It Be Morning, and Dancing Arabs. His forthcoming book is Native, Dispatches from an Israeli-Palestinian Life. Syed Kashua, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And with us on the road to Blacksburg, Virginia, is Etgar Karet, Israeli writer, filmmaker. The Paris Review says he's may be the most loved and widely read Israeli writer working today. He's author of Suddenly, A Knock on the Door, and The Bus Driver Who Wanted to Be God, and other stories. His new book is The Seven Good Years, a memoir. Etgar Karet, welcome back to On Point.
Hi.
Thank you very much for being with us. I don't know if you got to hear Gerald Steinberg or not. He says, look, He's looking out at what's happening right now, says there's a cycle here. Every 10 years or so, this happens. He's talking about conflict management, not resolution. You've written about how many Israelis have come to see this waves of violence as sort of like the weather, something about which maybe not a lot can be done. How do you see what's going on right now, Edgar? Oh, we lost Edgar Caret there. Syed Kashua, let me put the same question to you. How do you describe the roots, the backdrop to what we see right now in the streets of Jerusalem and beyond?
Yes. First of all, it's a very sad reality. And as someone who left Jerusalem last year after living there for 25 years, the last thing that I would expect from Israelis to say that they are surprised. The fact that it happens maybe one generation after another, it's because people cannot really stand the situation of living in East Jerusalem and in the West Bank. Instead of driving 3 hours to the occupied Golan Heights, it's better maybe to take a car to the neighborhoods in East Jerusalem for 15 minutes and just to see, you know, just to see the way that people live there in East Jerusalem, how much it's crowded. The fact that 75% of the people in East Jerusalem are considered to be under the poverty line. The fact, you know, it's just life not worth living. So I think we're talking here, by the way, most of the cases about 15 years old and 16 years old kids from East Jerusalem carrying sometimes screwdrivers and trying to revenge and kill Israelis. That's really very sad and that's really very tragic. And I see also in these guys and these kids who don't even have enough classes. By the way, East Jerusalem is under the authority of Israel, yes, since 67. So it's the Israeli education system, and it's the Israeli plan. Just today, this morning, the Supreme Court allowed Ateret Kohanim, a very extreme Israeli settlement group, and they evacuated another Palestinian family from the heart of Silwan. How does that work with coming to a, you know, solving the problem? How does that got anything to do with security? How just establishing new settlements in the heart of Jebel Mokaber and Silwan and other neighborhoods in East Jerusalem, what does that have anything to do with the security of Israelis? And of course, for me, as I wrote in my last column, one of my last columns, the Al-Aqsa is more than a religious place. It's just a symbol for Palestinians who no longer can draw their map or their homeland. And they are, of course, very much frustrated. And the Al-Aqsa and the yard there, it's the only open place that kids can play. Forget religious and Islam. I used to take my kids there to play there, and we never prayed. I stopped going there when my daughter, when she turned 12 or something like that, she was asked to cover her head. But that was the only place that you can feel some kind of freedom. And they think that it's playing innocence to blame it on religion and Islam, and not to mention occupation, and not to mention people living in a life that not worth living. So there's always a generation who see that frustration and they have nothing to do. And it's unfortunate, of course, and it's tragic, not unfortunate.
Sorry,
the only way that they can think is revenge.
Syed and Gerald Steinberg, please stand by. We're trying to get Edgar Caret back on the phone. He's on the road and we just lost him. But let me get a call first and put it to you, Gerald. You, Syed, Stephen in Windham, Connecticut, you're on.
Hey, thanks, Tom, for taking my call. You know, I've watched the Gaza invasion. I watched the last election, and Netanyahu and the Likudniks use all these lone wolf attacks, anything they can, to further their own political agenda. Even you see the Palestinians. I mean, how does lone wolf attacks turn into an... I mean, if this was Chicago, they would shut all of Chicago down. I mean, every city goes through waves of attacks. I mean, this is Netanyahu ginning up his political base once again.
What do you mean ginning them up? I mean, these are attacks. He's not calling these young people out with their knives. They're coming. So what do you mean ginning up?
He uses it again. He's using it as a collective punishment to rally the nation behind him. You're the only one that can solve the problem.
Let me pick up two pieces of that. Gerald Steinberg, our caller characterizes these as lone wolf attacks. You earlier talked about recruiting and training. I think the overall impression given in coverage of this is more on the lone wolf side, or part of a wave that's not necessarily actively recruited one by one. The social media sort of music that people may be hearing. How do you look at the backdrop to these attacks? Lone wolf or something else? And Syed, I'll put it to you as well.
The evidence is not clear, but there is, I'd say there's a line here that goes through many of the attacks, many of the attackers. They are young. In one case, I think we're talking about somebody who was mentally ill. These are people who are being exploited and manipulated, largely by Hamas. There's an element of Hamas versus Fatah, which is something that may be obscure, but that's internal Palestinian politics. Mahmoud Abbas is 80. He's a weak leader. This is also part of the challenge of the leadership. And they find the kids, they find people on the margins of society, as Palestinian terror groups have done for many, many years. There is a connection with Hamas in almost every attack.
You say they find. So you're not buying that they're just seeing reality around them or chatting with one another. And
you know, I live in Jerusalem, and I see a different reality than Syed Kashuach. He's right. I do go to the neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, but I also see in my own neighborhoods, in what's called West Jerusalem, more dominantly Jewish Jerusalem, mm-hmm. in the malls, in the shopping centers, the parks, everywhere, I see Palestinians or Arabs from the other part of Jerusalem going shopping, trying to have normal lives outside of the intense control and the corruption that they and their own society suffer. Blaming everything on Israel is really a very narrow and parochial perspective, and I think we should be looking at things more broadly. There is an opportunity for a more conducive mutual cooperation, or at least tolerance.
When you look more broadly and see, there's a lot to look at there, but Palestinians, I suppose, would point to settlement or occupation, as they say. How do you look at that? Is that a provocation to these youths?
Everything. But I don't think that 13-year-olds that go around and slashing because of what their cousins and their brothers do, which are influenced by Hamas, have any direct experience with occupation. Even what Syed Kashua talked about, he gives a partial history, talks about Silwan. Well, Silwan was an entirely Jewish neighborhood, Yemenite Jews, actually, who lived there until the 1920s, and then they were ethnically cleansed. So some of those houses belong to Jewish families.
Mr. Steinberg,
if it was somebody who's going to ask me for conflict management, I would say we can not demand that those houses be occupied by Jews because that creates conflict.
But may I get Syed in there for a moment? I'll come right back to you, Gerald. Syed?
Yes, I was just asking him if he would agree that everyone who lost his house in 48 get his original house before that he used to live in before 48. That time, I can assure you, most Palestinians, all the Palestinians, would accept. Yes, it's true, but of course, I used also to live in Jerusalem, and I saw the Palestinians in the malls and the streets of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. But after all, all the land and all the building planning in Jerusalem is just Jewish ones, and it's meant for settlements. And the fact
what
is that we are in the streets of Jerusalem, but we are the ones who clean the streets of Jerusalem, and we are the one who works in the kitchens of East Jerusalem. We are not really controlling. And when we are in the streets of Jerusalem, we are not claiming to have it and establish settlements there. We just visit, and we don't. I used to live in Western Jerusalem. I no way put a Palestinian flag, and it said, and I made a military basement out of it. I just wanted to live there as equal. So to say that people live in Jerusalem, Mr. Steinberg doesn't even know if they are citizens or not citizens. Are they occupied or not occupied? And does he really believe that they have the same rights as the people, the Jewish people in Jerusalem?
I'll put that question to him first. To you. He says Palestinians have a problem with corruption and poor leadership in their own ranks. What about that?
That's for sure. I'm not the one to mm-hmm. to protect or the Palestinian Authority or the Palestinian leadership at all. I just have I'm talking here about the people. I'm not talking here about leaders and politicians. I'm talking about the reality in East Jerusalem.
And the assertion that these young people are recruited or trained for these...
That's just nothing to do with reality. Nothing. And I think all the Israelis know very well that there is nothing, not even one institution, political or social, in East Jerusalem. When I used to study in Jerusalem, I went there to a boarding Jewish high school and then the Hebrew University. I've been living there for 25 years. Back in the 90s, in East Jerusalem, we had to have cinemas and theaters. It was all closed. We used to have, the Palestinians used to have newspapers and magazines and festivals. It was all shut down
by whom?
Israeli forces. Mm. By Israeli forces in the 90s. By Israeli forces. Jerusalem is disconnected from the rest of the West Bank. People from Ramallah cannot go to Jerusalem. It's just dark, just a dark place. If you go there after 8 o'clock, you will see nothing but crime and frustration. And it's surrounded by walls, of course.
Yeah.
And that's the reality there.
More now than a couple of weeks ago, but then more stabbings as well. We're talking about the latest wave of violence in Jerusalem and beyond. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Syed Kashua, stand by. We're still trying to reconnect with Ed Karkaret. I'm sorry we've lost him for the moment. Gerald Steinberg, Joe's calling from Edmond, Oklahoma. Joe, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out that your guest from Jerusalem made the point that these youths are, he's alluding to the fact that these youths only act out because they are targeted on the fringes, and he's completely disregarding any social or cultural, or rather downplaying any social or cultural forces behind it. You have to remember that he is someone who's looking from one perspective of the society in Jerusalem. It would much be akin to, you know, only getting the rundown of what, let's say, a white person might think in these times.
Well, we're not only getting that, Joe, as you can hear, but you're talking about Gerald Steinberg's assertion that Hamas is somehow behind these attacks, and is that what you're disputing?
Well, I'm disputing the fact that your guest is downplaying the social forces at work.
And what do you mean by social forces? That can mean a lot of things. What do you mean by that?
The oppression that the living conditions in general, the fact that most Palestinians the Palestinians are majority in Israel, but they live in a smaller percentage, on average, on smaller percentages of land.
Joe, we've got it. Let me take that perspective to Gerald Steinberg. Gerald, you hear our caller from Oklahoma. You hear Syed saying, look, Palestinians in Jerusalem, just for starters, have been stripped of a lot of things they used to enjoy. And it's not a surprise that their frustration would be there at all.
There's a problem, a very deep problem, with trying to apply the American analogy, the civil rights movement, whites and blacks, to any other country, but particularly in this case of Israel and the Palestinians. It simply doesn't work.
Well, I didn't hear the civil rights motif applied. Just these are two peoples, as you've pointed out.
Well, I heard it from the last caller.
Okay.
And I see it. I read it a lot. I read it in the New York Times. The correspondents tend to apply their framework to a very, very foreign environment with a very long history and mutual fears. All these arguments, everything that's raised has some validity, but it's in a much more complex situation. And I want to go back to that point that from an Israeli perspective, the main consensus of Israelis, who do vote for Netanyahu by a small margin, but they do, that there's this great fear that here we are on this tiny piece of land after 2,000 years of being pushed around and bumped around and massacred and killed. This is our only chance to maintain our society and to return to our homeland, to restructure our language, our history, our massive culture, everything else. Jews, Israelis, Zionists didn't come to Israel in order to fight Palestinians. And the problem here is that we are being fought from the other side. And so you get an action and reaction process. Palestinians in East Jerusalem, when things were under Teddy Kollek, where things were relatively quiet, where there was a sort of a live and let live process, there were two isolated societies with some movement back and forth. And that eroded. It was probably not possible to maintain that forever. Modern society doesn't allow that to happen. And you get this point of friction all along the way.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the mounting wave of Palestinian stabbings and Israeli response, the conflict bloody again in the Middle East. Gerald Steinberg is with us from Bar Ilan University. Syed Kashua, Israeli Arab Palestinian, left there last year for the United States and the Midwest. Couldn't take it anymore. He joins us today from Urbana and the University of Illinois. His forthcoming book is Native, Dispatches from an Israeli-Palestinian Life. Edgar Caret, Israeli writer and filmmaker, joins us as well, and you can join us. What do you see unfolding here? What's old? What's new? What should we be paying attention to now in everything that we're seeing? Earlier today in the southern city, well beyond Jerusalem, in Beersheba, there was an attack in a bus station. Israeli soldier killed, six, eight, 10 Israelis wounded there. And then an Eritrean man who wasn't part of it but was mistaken for part of the attack hit and beaten by a mob of Israelis. Here's NBC News chief global correspondent Bill Neely reporting this morning.
The crowd thought the young man, who was Eritrean, had something to do with it. First of all, a security man shot him, and then the crowd turned on him and beat him so badly that he died later in the hospital of his injuries. Another example of how the innocent are getting caught up in the fear and the fury here.
John Kerry headed to try and talk with leaders of both the Palestinians and of Israel. The president talking to this on Friday in a news conference, asking people on both sides, all sides, to try and tamp down the rhetoric.
It's important for both Prime Minister Netanyahu and Israeli elected officials and President Abbas and other people in positions of power to try to tamp down rhetoric that may feed violence or anger or misunderstanding.
Gerald Steinberg, Syed Kashua, please stand by. Edgar Caret joins us right now on the road to Harrisonburg, Virginia. Edgar Caret, thank you very much for being with us. What do you see unfolding here, Edgar?
Yeah, well, first I have to apologize because I had no chance to see what they are saying. But what I feel is that as an Israel, you know, who was born and raised in Israel and lived there all my life, that the big difference that I feel now is even in the hardest times that we had in the region, I think both sides could imagine some kind of a best-case scenario, a better scenario, something that could turn for the better. And right now, you know, I think this horizon does not exist, you know. And frankly speaking, you know, when, let's say, Naftali Bennett, the minister in the Netanyahu government, says that the two-state solution is dead, you know, when Netanyahu, when the government, they're mostly out there kind of bashing Mahmoud Abbas, who is, from an Israeli point of view or from a moderate Israeli point of view, is the only partner we can speak to, you know. I mean, it's either speaking to him or Hamas or letting the Palestinian Authority crash. Then I think that, you know, the situation is totally hopeless. And I think that, you know, that, of course, when you talk about such a wave of terror, you know, there are many reasons that you can come up with. But in the bottom line, I think that this feeling of despair, which is very hard, you know, at both sides, it's what makes this wave seem to be so much worse than the one that we had before.
Worse than before. Say, Kashua, what about this feeling of despair? Maybe on both sides, says Edgar Caret. Do you still see a way out of this toward two-state solution? Gerald Steinberg talks about conflict management. There's a kind of suggestion there, I'll ask him, but that this unsettled thing could go on for many years. What's the way out, Syed?
You know, it's comparing the spear, the Palestinian one, to the Israeli one would be absolutely unfair.
Okay.
There is no way to compare life in Tel Aviv to life in Jerusalem. There is no way to compare life in Gaza to the life of Israelis in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and other Israeli cities. It is tragic and it's sad that people are killed in the streets of Israel, of course, but we have to remember that Palestinian kids, teenagers, and people are, and innocent people are killed during the whole days of the year. It comes to the news, unfortunately, in Israel, because for the Israeli media or the mainstream, it happens only when Israelis are killed. Mm. It's tragic, but that's the reality of Palestinians. They are the ones who are living behind the wall and without ability to move and work. They are the ones to see their land taken part by part every year. I think that, you know what? I'm not a huge fan of the Palestinian leaders, of course, but at least I know that Mahmoud Abbas is very decent, and the same things that he says to the Palestinian, he says to the Israelis. And it's very clear to the Israeli, at least military people, that he's doing his best. The fact that there is no intifada in the West Bank, it's because of the Palestinian Authority. Mm. The fact that it's happening in Jerusalem mainly and different places, it's because it's under the Israeli security control. That's the reason why. But I say I'm not sure about one state. So it is one state, by the way. Let's talk reality. It is one state. Israel is controlling the West Bank, and of course there are more than 1,500,000 Palestinians living as citizens, just myself,
yes,
inside
Israel.
But does
that mean you give up on two states? Are you giving up on two states as well?
I'm not
Naftali Bennett says,
I would accept any kind of solution that gives the Palestinians equal right, human rights, that stops the suffering of the Palestinians. Any solution, a two state solution, some people would say, because of the settlements, it looks like impossible. No one in Israel thinks that he can really fight evacuating settlers. Benjamin Netanyahu himself says, unfortunately, that he, in the elections, this and before the elections, that there will be no Palestinian state. What is the Palestinian state exactly? That he says that he's not going to dismantle settlements, as he says that he will never give the East Jerusalem back to the Palestinian state. So it is now one state. It is one state, unequal state. When it comes to the citizens of the Palestinian citizen of Israel, just like myself, and it's unfortunately apartheid when it comes to the people in the West Bank and Gaza, that they don't have any civil rights at all. Even the people of Jerusalem, they don't have the right to vote for the Knesset. They are not really citizens. They have no rights, almost no rights. They have some kind of rights. So any solution that will, you know, save lives and would be accepted on me. But again, I'm not a politician.
Jill Sternberg,
One thing at least the Palestinian Authority have a plan. They say, we want to establish a Palestinian state on the border of 67. I don't know what's Mr. Netanyahu plan is. He never said. Is it transfer? Is it just two states, one state? Nothing. I don't know what are his plans. Actually, the only thing that it seems the Israeli government is expecting from the Palestinians is just to be quiet, watching their land and their rights being taken from them, and to be quiet when they see that it's just a very slow and a very good ethnic cleansing. Unfortunately, that's the only words that I can use when I see the reality in Palestine and the reality of East Jerusalem.
Syed, stand by. I'm sorry, but we've lost Edgar Caret again. There was a mix-up on him getting to the studio this morning, and it's put us in a very difficult situation on that front. Gerald Steinberg, you say the civil rights, the U.S. civil rights paradigm is not the right way to look at this, but what about human rights? Syed, raises ethnic cleansing, apartheid. What about that characterization? And whatever you call it, can this status quo go on in perpetuity? Is that what conflict management means in your mind?
One sentence, and that is the kind of language that I heard from Syed Kashoa is very depressing, because it's the language of genocide. It's the language of saying we want to wipe Israel off the earth.
No, I did not hear that. I did hear him saying he respected the suffering of Israelis dying as well, Jews dying as well in Jerusalem.
The language of it, those are all very clear signals when he says ethnic cleansing and apartheid and all that other language. That's the language of what we call the Durban Conference of 2001, and the goal is no Israel. The Jews don't have a right to national sovereignty, and I hope that he will correct that and not use that kind of inflammatory language. We do
please
have
don't please let me speak for myself,
okay.
Mr. Steinberg.
I'm
please
speaking for myself, and I think that language is
no. Moral. You are speaking for myself, for me again. You are telling my narrative. Don't do that, please.
I'm certainly not selling your narrative. But, in terms of the practical aspects, there are. In every society, in these societies, there are significant parts of the population that are not on the fringes, that don't want to see bloodletting and killing and everything else that goes on forever. It's very difficult to mobilize those people. It's difficult on the Israeli side, and it's almost non-existent on the Palestinian side.
But if there's not a two-state solution, and you have Palestinians in some pretty rough circumstances here, are you saying that's just the way it's going to be?
No, I'm saying that anybody who thinks they can predict the future, we say in Hebrew and in Israel among Jews that the prophecy ended after the destruction of the Second Temple. Only fools have prophecy.
Yeah, but one can try. I mean, 20 years ago, it was an Israeli leader who would ultimately be assassinated, of course.
But again, I don't want to go into that and whether it would have made any difference or not. But the point is, where are we now? Where are we now? And I think my view of Mr. Netanyahu is that he wants a coalition government with Mr. Herzog. He's got to get on both sides, the people to the right of Netanyahu, to the left of Herzog, have to be weakened so that they can forge a unity government, because the status quo does not benefit Israel. There are the majority of Israel. I'm saying that right now, that Israel needs to make concessions and compromises, and I'd like to hear Mr. Kashua say the same thing about Palestinians, that Palestinian images of right of return, meaning no Israel, the language that he used, instead of saying, we know that we've made mistakes, that the Arabs should not have invaded Israel and rejected the UN partition resolution of 47 and everything that came afterwards, the kind of language even that bosses use it about polluting, that Jews pollute the holy sites with their feet, things like that, that kind of language doesn't contribute. And that's why there's an emphasis, first let's try to tone down the language, we heard that from Mr. Obama, I don't know what they can do to contribute to that, and then let's see if we can go forward to confidence-building measures. Let's not try to solve everything, which we've always tried, these massive agreements, piece by piece. And there will be Israeli cooperation. Israelis are tired of this conflict.
Joel Steinberg, hold the thought there, if you'd be good enough. I think I've got Ikar Karet back on the line again. We're talking about the latest violence in Israel and beyond. Said, I have to come to you first just to clarify. Gerald hears, in your characterization, an unwillingness to accept the existence of Israel. Could you just speak to that, and then I'll take it to Edgar.
That was just cruel, and that's nothing to do with the reality. And I'm really very sorry that Mr. Steinberg thinks that someone is calling for equal rights for people live in the same land and share the same lands. It's demolishing the state of Israel. I think that any decent people who reads me and knows my ideas will understand that I never called that. Unlike Mr. Steinberg, I do very much recognize the suffering of the Jewish people. And unlike Mr. Steinberg, I see myself as an equal. I wanted to see myself as a citizen of the state of Israel, and I always fought as a citizen of the state of Israel that wants to make this place also worth living for his kids, Arab kids and Jewish kids, just the same. I'm really very sorry to hear that that's enough to call for equality. Is that really demolishing the state of Israel? I accepted the fact that Israel is there. I was born there. That's the language that I'm using for writing, and it's the only citizenship that I'm carrying. To say that I want to demolish the state of Israel, meaning that I want to kill my friends just like Edgar Keret and the neighborhood and my neighbors that I used to live in, and they are very dear people. So that would be a very big lie to say. The problem is that unfortunately, the 48 war that we accepted is still happening. Taking lands from the Palestinians is still happening. It's not just a traumatic thing that happened in 48 for the Palestinian people. It's still happening every day. Every day, even for the citizens, we're supposed to be citizens of the state of Israel, even for the Palestinians inside Israel, taking houses and cutting their, you know, their dreams for a better future. Yeah. The fact that we are citizens and not even one village was established after 48 for us, unlike more than 700 settlements, I mean, in Israel, not in the occupied territories.
Sorry, hold it there if you'd be good enough.
I very much hope that he will apologize for blaming me or accusing me of the one who wants to destroy the state of Israel.
Heard. Edgar Karet, I think we've got you back again. I want you to... our connection's been so bad. Just tell us what you most want us to know in this situation, Edgar.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry because I was cut before. And what I wanted to say when I talk about the despair, that I think the despair in Israeli society is government induced. I really think that, you know, that the current government wants more than anything, that people like Mahmoud Abbas will fall and that there will be chaos on the Palestinian side. Because as long as there's somebody on the Palestinian side calling for negotiation, then people who give up on the two-state solution or give up on negotiation or the government look bad. But if they'll be able to destroy Palestinian society enough in which they can declare there will be no partner, this is when they will be winning. And I think that, you know, that Jews for hundreds of years have prayed in the Wailing Wall. I truly do not believe that people who go and pray in Temple Mount do it innocently. And when people talk about returning the status quo, then I can say to you as a writer that when you return something, then you change something. The status quo is that most rabbis say, you know, that you should go and pray in the Wailing Wall. And people who go to the Temple Mount, like many other action taken by this government, they're basically done to disrupt and destroy the Palestinian Authority, bring Israel chaos, and then people like Bennett could happily say, you know, that there is no partner, and there could not be no Palestinian state. I'm sorry that I couldn't really be a part of the discussion, but I
was
blamed.
I was blamed by Mr. Hello? Steinberg that I'm a one who wants to destroy the state of Israel.
Just go ahead, please. We just have half a minute.
What I really want to say is that I think that the struggle we're struggling now is really a struggle to break this kind of narrative, saying that, you know, comparing, I don't know, Palestinian society to ISIS or the other people. We have a territorial dispute, and this dispute will not be solved until the Palestinian can live in an independent entity. You know, no steps in this direction have been taken. I don't believe Netanyahu won.
Eckhart Caret, it's been a difficult logistical hour, but we appreciate your hanging in there and trying to be on with us. Induced despair, Edgar says. Syed Kashua says, open to both sides, but we've got rough stuff. Gerald Steinberg, conflict management as the path. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today as we continue to watch this unfold, sadly, too bloody. Gerald Steinberg, Syed Kashua, Edgar Caret. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.